I'm Rich Eggeran. This is In the Tri-States, a review of the news of the past month. State Senator John Sullivan of Rushville announced on August 19th that he would take a leave of absence to be treated for a rare form of cancer. The Democratic lawmaker says he has liposarcoma. It's a type of cancer that's usually found in the fat cells of the legs. Sullivan says he had a small growth removed from his lower abdomen 4 years ago. His doctor recently noticed a recurrence, so he had another surgical procedure performed last month. His office says the surgery was successful, and Sullivan is expected to return to his full-time duties by early September. Sullivan has served as state senator for the past 10 years. He's up for re-election this year. A key source of revenue for Burlington will remain in place for the foreseeable future. Public Radio's Jason Parrott had the story on August 8th.
Just under 1,400 voters turned out for yesterday's special election on the future of a 1 cent local option sales and service tax, and more than 1,150 of them voted in favor of keeping the tax in place for 10 more years starting January 1st. That works out to more than 85% of the ballots cast being in support of the tax. City Manager Jim Furno says it generates nearly $4 million each year for Burlington. Half goes to property tax relief and the rest is spent on equipment and personnel, including 8 police officers. Voter turnout was just under 9% for the special election. I'm Jason Parrott.
Also on the first Tuesday of August, voters chose not to give a member of the Clark County Board of Commissioners a chance to keep his seat. Incumbent Roger Sedor was defeated by Paul Brotherton in the Democratic primary for Western District Commissioner. Brotherton received 42% of the votes cast to defeat Sedor and Ed Knoop. Meanwhile, Henry Dienst was victorious over Larry Saxton, 69% to 31%, in the Republican primary for Eastern District Commissioner. Clark County voters also agreed to a 4-year extension of a special property tax for road and bridge improvements, 71% to 29%. Lewis County voters agreed during the primary to make a pair of sales taxes permanent. The 3/8% tax for road and bridge improvements was approved 64% to 36%. A similar tax for government operations was approved 59% to 41%. But a ballot referendum changing local laws for fences was soundly defeated, 73% to 27%. We learned last month there will soon be a new mayor of Bushnell. Public Radio's Jim Lenz was the first reporter with the story on August 7th.
Current Mayor Steve Russell says he's been thinking about his future for some time and decided he won't run for a third term.
I served 10 years on the council, 8 as mayor, and I figured time for a new person to try to see what they can do for Bushnell.
Russell says he announced his decision now to give the Citizens Party plenty of time to find another candidate. Russell says he will fill the party's vacant chairmanship. He is recruiting candidates to run for mayor, city clerk, and city council seats in next year's election. I'm Jim Lenz.
It's been an especially tough summer for farmers. The combination of high temperatures and little rain impacted just about every type of producer. Nonetheless, some are finding ways to get by. One of them is John Curtis. He owns a community-supported agriculture operation called Barefoot Gardens. It's a small farm. Most of the crops are grown on about 2.5 acres. Curtis told us last month he's been gardening for 20 years and has never gone through a summer like this.
This weather just means that I need to water more often. I really need to put down 2 inches of water a week on any given patch of the garden, and I just about can't do that unless I'm running sprinklers all the time.
And how are you managing that? I think you had to dig your well a little deeper, is that correct?
Yeah, we had to do some work on the well, and I have ongoing issues with my pump. So sometimes I have water and sometimes I don't, but when I don't, it really shows quickly.
Have you lost any crops, or have you been unable to grow any particular crops because of how dry and hot it's been?
Yes, I had plans to have 2 significant sweet corn crops, and it just wasn't going to be possible for me. There wasn't enough moisture in the soil to grow sweet corn this year, and a lot of the crops are really stunted. The broccoli isn't doing as well as it might have. On the other hand, I have some crops that have done very well. Onions really like dry weather, so we have a beautiful onion crop, and the tomatoes have done spectacularly in spite of the dry weather.
I know you like to continue producing crops well into the fall. Is the hot summer affecting what you're going to be able to produce this fall?
I'll still have my fall crops if my water system holds out and if my well holds out. It takes a lot of water to get enough moisture in the soil even to get those fall crops established. And, everything depends on water, and especially since we're not getting any help from the heavens.
What about other producers? Do you talk to many other farmers, and what are you hearing from them?
Well, everyone's kind of discouraged. I met with a couple local cattle producers, and their pastures are in terrible shape. And other vegetable growers, of course, are suffering terribly. I mean, when you have to deliver every drop of water that your plants get, it takes a toll. It's really a lot more like agriculture out west. And, in the land of the tall grass prairie where we live, we're not used to these extremely dry, hot summers and springs and falls and winters. So we may need to adjust. We may need to have a lot more drip irrigation, and might need to set up some shade systems for certain crops. It's a challenge.
Can you manage at least the small farm that you have, the small operation that you have? Could you manage another year like this, or what would be the challenges a year from now if this drought persists?
Well, I would become a dryland gardener. I would use a lot more drip irrigation, and I would just assume that I'm not going to have any water, or not nearly enough water from rain. So, yeah, it would be, I could make that adjustment, because there are a lot of operations my size or a little bigger out on the West Coast and in the dry Southwest that do this sort of thing. But it's a different kind of setup, and it's if this weather pattern persisted for years, the Midwest is going to become a different landscape altogether, and I'm starting to worry about the trees and a lot of the things that I normally wouldn't be concerned about.
John Curtis thinks smaller farms might be better equipped to adapt to changing conditions than larger operations. He also says a continued drought will be especially tough on corn, which requires quite a bit of water. Curtis owns and operates Barefoot Gardens. The CSA is near Macomb. Curtis is also board president for the Illinois Stewardship Alliance. One of Iowa's largest agribusiness companies has a huge investment riding on this year's prolonged drought. A new hybrid seed corn developed by DuPont Pioneer is being touted for its ability to improve yields under the driest conditions. Public Radio's Rick Frederickson filed this story on the final day of August.
The subpar corn harvest of 2012 is coming in early after the worst growing conditions in more than two decades.
We've been really dry all summer. I talked to an older gentleman some time ago that said that he had taken 47 crops off of his farm, and this was about the worst that he'd ever seen it.
Bill Simmons is combining multiple corn varieties on the Klan farm outside Atlantic. One field stands out. Pioneer's new drought-resistant brand, Aquamax.
Well, it's doing really well for us. I mean, all things considered, what I've been in so far, we're running about 50 bushel better in the Aquamax corn.
Pioneer's main competition, Monsanto and Syngenta, are out with their own anti-drought varieties. Syngenta's artesian corn is being tested now in Iowa's dehydrated landscape. The early signs are promising there, too, but experts say it's too early to celebrate. Chad Hart is a grain marketing specialist at Iowa State University.
I would say we do need to look at this fairly cautiously as looking at the impact here. Sometimes what we find is that we try out something, it works in the lab, but when we go out into the field, conditions are not the same. Things look good so far, but the proof is in the yield at the end of the year.
2 million acres of Aquamax were planted across the Corn Belt this year, starting here at Pioneer's test farm in Johnston. The product rollout represents years of lab work and a big share of the billion-dollar ag research budget for parent company DuPont. Greg Luce is a Pioneer agronomist.
We now can map the corn plant, and we can identify genes that have a positive influence on corn under drought, and we can speed up the process of developing targeted drought products. So in the past, we had to just grow things out and see how they did under stress. Well, it's a lot more focused effort than that, and genetic markers has been a big key to that.
There's a lot at stake in this new hybrid revolution, from global warming implications to feeding the world. ISU professor Chad Hart.
When you look back over the past 60 years here in Iowa looking at corn and soybeans, nearly half the time the reason we lose a crop is because of a drought or very dry conditions. So if we can breed the crop to be tolerant of those conditions, to still maintain that yield, it is a game changer then, if we can pull it off.
Pioneer started researching drought-resilient corn in the 1950s. Business director Todd Fraser expects its newest designer corn to be a key option as farmers buy seed for 2013.
Yes, we're getting very good feedback on Aquamax hybrids this year. Unfortunately, we put them to a pretty severe test or significant test with as severe as the drought was this year. The future of Aquamax is definitely expansion. We'll see a significant increase next year for 2013 planting in Aquamax hybrids, and we've just launched Aquamax in Europe as well.
Fraser cautions that these new drought-busting varieties still need water. They're not a cactus. Agriculture Secretary Bill Northey says this year's drought has been the best test possible for the newly engineered seed corn.
All farmers are interested in it. Obviously, after this year, we're really interested in it. But it still has to be in its right place. We don't expect a drought every year. We do probably expect some period of dry weather. And at the end of the day, it's going to be how does it yield compared to other crops.
As summer winds down on the most widespread drought in more than half a century, the verdict on drought-resistant technology is in the harvest. If yield predictions perform as advertised, the Agriculture Secretary says it could boost planting acreage by turning forgotten drought-prone land into productive cornfields. Near Atlantic, I'm Rick Fredrickson, Iowa Public Radio News.
Western Illinois University broke ground on August 29th for the second phase of its new riverfront campus in Moline. Governor Pat Quinn called it a prudent investment by the people of the state.
We believe in jobs, and one of the very best ways to have good jobs today and tomorrow is to invest in education. We want to make sure that all of our students get a good education.
Quinn thanked John Deere for donating its former tech center for the campus. The first building at the new campus opened in January. More and more children are being diagnosed with autism. The medical condition causes them to struggle in their dealings with others, but with support, they can learn how to improve. Public Radio's Jim Lenz has this story from the final day of August.
One such youngster is Andres Montiel Cabal. He's just 13, yet stands nearly 6 feet tall. He is wearing black-rimmed glasses, a T-shirt, jeans, and a broad smile. While he is smiling now, school sometimes brings a frown to his face. School is one of his biggest challenges.
For me, I'm doing okay, although I can do a jillion times better than the way I'm doing right now.
Autism affects development of social and communication skills. As a result, Andre sometimes finds it difficult to make friends at school, and he says every once in a while he is teased.
in my school, they, you know, tend to have it to be antisocial. You know, like, not so easygoing. Like, you know, they say, like, bad words. Sometimes they say it at me, and sometimes they say it at others.
Andre's younger brother, Pablo, is also autistic, and they're not alone. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says autism was diagnosed in 1 in 88 children in 2008, the last year for which figures are available. That's a sharp rise from 2000, when 1 in 150 children was diagnosed with autism. Andres and Pablo's mother is Munya Cabal Jimenez. She says her boys are lucky to have each other.
They can actually have someone to interact socially. Some children are not that lucky to have a sibling. They interact very well. At the very first, it was very tough.
Cabal Jimenez says she had to learn to adapt to her boys' needs. She says it was important to develop a specific routine for them early on. As they got older, she taught them to be a bit more flexible.
They just understand and communicate in a very different way. And you need to learn their language. It's not the other way around that you made them to learn our language. You have to come closer and communicate.
Cabal Jimenez moved to Macomb a couple years ago. She would like to see the school system provide a bit more support for her sons.
There are not as many resources as I had in the first years. And the support is more in terms of aids for one of them. In terms of other aspects, the staff here is not as strained as in other school districts.
Much of what is available in Macomb comes through the West Central Illinois Special Education Cooperative. The cooperative's CK Best agrees there is a need for more services for autistic children. Best also agrees that autistic children learn in a unique way.
Visuals, visuals, visuals for learning, for helping them express themselves, for helping them learn emotions, and social skills training.
Those aids include cartoon depictions of acceptable behavior in classrooms and other social situations. They can also include a game in which children have to match pictures that are similar but not identical. Best says the increasing number of local diagnoses mirrors the national trend. That increase will put more pressure on the support structure. Best says up to 80% of the students with autism in West Central Illinois are taught in regular classrooms with support. For example, the Macomb School District provides aides who often work one-on-one with the autistic students. The aides use visual depictions to reinforce the lessons with the autistic students. They also help autistic students deal with changes to their daily schedules. Such changes can create a great deal of anxiety for many of these children. Despite his struggles, Andres Montiel Cabal is optimistic and says he will follow his father's advice when he finishes school.
It's like my dad always says, get a job, get a really, really good job.
He hopes to own a Ferrari one day with the money he earns at that job. While Andres is confident about his future, his mother worries. Munya Cabal Jimenez says the U.S. has no plan to support autistic children when they grow into adulthood. She says with the increasing number of diagnoses, this is a public health problem that needs to be addressed. I'm Jim Lenz.
The first day of school is an exciting day for many students of all ages. It's filled with new classes, new textbooks, new teachers, and new opportunities. There was one more new for students in two Southeast Iowa school districts to get excited about. New schools. Public Radio's Jason Parrott has this story from August 17th.
Edward Stone Middle School, this is Becky. Can I help you?
That sounds pretty natural, but Becky Carl says the first few times she picked up a phone this summer, she said James Madison Middle School.
I did the first couple days. I think I'm used to it now, answering the phone, Edward Stone.
It was a force of habit for Carl, who was James Madison's secretary for 3 years. Now, she is secretary for the Burlington School District's newest school, which is located just off of Mason Road on the city's west side. Carl says there are plenty of differences between her offices at each school.
We have a lot more storage here in this office. It's a lot bigger than the old office. I think it's going to be a lot nicer.
There is also new equipment and technology to get used to, including a state-of-the-art surveillance system. Carl says everyone has been working hard to get everything ready for the students.
It has been a lot of work, but the new building is beautiful. It's been worth it.
Buildings and Grounds Supervisor Byron Whittlesey has been busy getting Edward Stone Middle School ready for the first day of school on Monday. But he found some time to take me on a tour a few days ago.
This building is fully up to code, fully life safety, high efficiency lighting, plenty of parking, plenty of site accessibility.
The accessibility Whittlesey describes is created by having most of the common use rooms on the first floor of the school, which is basically a giant rectangle. An exception is the west end of the building, which stands three stories tall.
The three-story structure we refer to as the tower. It is actually the academic structure. It's sixth grade on first floor, seventh grade on second, eighth grade on third.
Now, as we kind of look into some of these classrooms here, they're all really on the borders of the school here. Seems like a lot of natural light, a lot of openness. Was that kind of a goal in putting these rooms together?
Yeah, naturally, we want to introduce as much of the outdoor environment inside to make a more homely feel or an easier feel.
There are also computer labs on each floor, wireless internet throughout the building, and interactive smart boards in each classroom. Some of the other highlights include a massive gymnasium with two full basketball courts and an auditorium.
We have retractable seating that will seat, I think, 477 people, plus we have 180 chairs that we can set in front. We have a great big large stage. We have a high school lighting system as well as a full high school sound system.
Whittlesey says the roughly 113,000 square foot school was designed for up to 500 students, though he says it could comfortably serve up to 600 if enrollment swells. He says the final tasks before opening day include hanging fire extinguishers and soap dispensers, polishing the floors, and setting up shelving. Meanwhile, about 20 miles to the south, things are a little farther behind.
The school itself is in good shape. The academic wings, all the classrooms, they're ready to go. Where we're just going to be pushing it is the more of the common areas. The cafeteria, the gym, those are the two biggies that they save to last.
That's Fort Madison Middle School Principal Todd Durth this week, talking about the district's new school on the city's west side near Bluff Road. In fact, the contractors had blocked access to much of the building the day I showed up so they could work on the cafeteria and gymnasium floors. Since then, the teachers have been able to get into their new classrooms for the first time ahead of the start of school on Wednesday.
We've been talking all summer, and they know that their rooms will not be perfect when the kids arrive. It's going to be an ongoing process as we work out the kinks and take care of little things like that.
Durth says the classroom technology will be installed after teachers decide where it goes. The new middle school features three academic wings and can serve about 800 students. Durth says one wing is fourth grade only, so these students can get used to a larger school. The two remaining wings are shared, one for fifth and sixth, and the other will have seventh and eighth grades. Durth says the academic wings are even color coordinated in case students get lost. A fourth wing features the gymnasium, locker rooms, and rooms for band and chorus. Durth says the new school is more visually appealing and accessible than the old one. In addition, the classrooms will provide greater benefits for Fort Madison students.
They all have data ports. They have much better outlets to handle technology. None of our windows open, and that's a good thing. It's all air conditioning. So we have a separate wall for screens for the LCD projectors and things like that. And it's a much quieter building.
The advanced features in the new schools in Fort Madison and Burlington are made possible by contributions from people throughout the country or even around the world. That's because the districts borrowed millions of dollars against the statewide 1 cent local option sales tax for education, and the public will soon get a look at its investments. Fort Madison will hold an open house next month. Burlington is jumping in head first with a ribbon cutting Sunday afternoon at 3 featuring Dr. Edward Stone, who is the new middle school's namesake. Stone grew up in Burlington and works for NASA. He's been involved in space exploration for decades, in particular the Voyager missions. Administrators in both districts hope the new opportunities these new buildings offer their students will prepare them to aim for the stars. I'm Jason Parrott.
The story told at Dixon Mounds Museum ends in 1673 when the French first arrived in West Central Illinois, but new exhibits are planned to explore the relationship between Native Americans and the early settlers from Europe. The exhibits will be installed as they're ready, and the museum could look much different by this time next year. Museum Director Michael Wyant says the new exhibits will cover around 160 years. They'll conclude with the Black Hawk War, which led to the end of natives holding land in Illinois. Wyant says no current exhibits will be replaced to make way for the new.
We like the way we tell the story so far, so we're going to leave that in place. It turns out that much of the work that was done here when the museum was renovated in the early 90s really focused on the floor and away from the walls. That means that the walls effectively are now a bare canvas that we have to work with. So there are ways that we're going to integrate this broader story into the perimeter of the exhibit. So things will stay the same, but they'll also be quite different.
What are some of the things visitors will see with these new exhibits?
Well, one thing I think will surprise them are the maps of the land treaties. It turns out that the ground we're on right now, on this west side of the Illinois River, from Calhoun County at the confluence of the Illinois and the Mississippi, all the way to Rock Island, was ceded to the United States in a single treaty, negotiated under some duress in St. Louis, and eventually would become what's known as the military tract, land given to veterans of the War of 1812. So we're going to produce those treaty maps and some of the text of treaties. And using contemporary technology, we can use things like QR codes so that people with smartphones and other applications, if they want to dig deeper into it, they could go right to the treaty language and read it if they wanted to while they were standing there looking at the maps.
Are there any other things from the new exhibits that you would like to highlight?
One thing we're going to do, for many years we've been asked a question about the burial exhibit. There are many people who still recall it. It still remains a difficult issue, supporters, detractors, and so on. But clearly there's curiosity. What we have done is digitized. We've created an electronic version of what the burial exhibit was like. And in using it as a backdrop, we can tell the story about what anthropologists have learned about the past here. This becomes important because while we can look at animal remains and plant remains, we can look at spearheads and pieces of pottery, it turns out that human beings tell us a story that we can't gain otherwise. So we're going to use this three-dimensional digital exhibit as a backdrop, and it will be a backdrop to telling the story about what these people told us about the past.
What do you mean by a three-dimensional digital exhibit?
So imagine a flat panel monitor, and when you turn it on, the image that you see is in 3D, and it is a rendering of the exhibit that you would have seen here if you'd traveled to this museum anytime between 1927 and 1991. And because it's digital, it allows us to maneuver ourselves around in it. So in a sense, you can look more closely at a particular individual or move away, look at the overview of them. It also gives us the kind of technology, for example, that it may be a touch screen kind of application, where if you touched the remains of a person, it would give them voice, if you will, and that voice could be a narration, an autobiographical narration about, this is what my life was like. I lived so long. I had some events in my life that had to do with my health and well-being and so on. So we think the time is right to relate to people the extraordinary amount of information that we gathered from the site that was here at Dixon Mounds.
There won't be any actual remains on display.
No remains on display. No remains, no photographs of remains, no real drawings of remains. In fact, the way the exhibit is created is we used a generic digital skeleton and essentially pieced it together anatomically so that it is a representation, but it doesn't use any of the materials that are controversial. So we want to be respectful in the way we educate, but we think that there is educational material there, and we're hoping an exhibit like this will be a common ground. So we're informed about the past, but we use a means by which people won't find offensive.
Dr. Michael Wyant is director of Dixon Mounds Museum. Last month, he unveiled the museum's plans for new exhibits. In the Tri-States, thanks to Jason Parrott, Jim Lenz, and Rick Frederickson for their contributions. For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Rich Egger.